a hoist for pulling an engine block out of a vehicle, and lining one wall were boxes of unopened rations. Ernie noticed John looking around and smiled.
"Were you a Boy Scout?" he asked.
"Yes, Nate Eagle."
"Well, Boy Scout, remember, be prepared.
My family and I took it seriously. If everyone had, we wouldn't be in this damn mess now." Ernie led the way upstairs to a spacious two-story-high living room, a cheery fire roaring in the fireplace, radiating warmth. Ernie's wife, Linda, was in the kitchen in the vast open room, looking up, smiling and coming around the corner, carrying two cups of coffee, no less. John sighed. "Why is it everyone seems to have a stockpile of coffee stashed away except me?"
"Again, Boy Scouts, be prepared."
John tried not to bristle. Ernie could be so darn annoying at times, rubbing in these types of things. But on the other hand, whether the final incident with Fredericks had been a setup by Ernie or not, he had dropped the guy, and now he just might be on the verge of unlocking some deadly serious questions as a follow-up performance. The rest of Ernie's extended family came out from the far side of the house to meet them. His sons, grandchildren, and daughter, and her reclusive author husband, the daughter offering to help John and Maury shuck off their parka scarves and gloves. Ernie produced a bottle of fine brandy from under the kitchen sink and offered to put something extra into their coffee. And though tempted, John declined. This was not a social visit. The business was dead serious, and he wanted a clear mind to evaluate why Ernie had so urgently requested his visiting the Franklin Enclave, as everyone now called it, a visit that few had been permitted to experience. "Let's head upstairs," Linda announced without further ado, and social small talk with the rest of the family. Linda had rarely attended community meetings, and John thought her to be somewhat standoffish until Michaela, after meeting her, told John she suspected Linda had Asperger's. Unlike most, John knew what it meant, and for him it carried no negative stereotypes. An Aspie, John knew, might not be up to par on most social skills, especially the ability to wander a crowd, meet and greet, and engage in small talk hour after hour. They tended to be mono-focused at times, to the point of absolute obsession. It might be something society might think inane— the history of pinball machines and how to repair them, or 19th-century railroads and the hauling capability of every engine ever made back then. In fact, if he could find people with that knowledge, he would have embraced them and put them to work to actually make such a machine to use on the abandoned Norfolk and Southern rails. For Linda, it was software design, and in a long-ago world, she had been one of the first programmers for the guidance systems for Saturn V rockets. She was a lone woman in a sea of techno-geek males of the early 1960s, writing guidance software for computers that had yet to even be made. So intense was the space race back then to get it done within President Kennedy's timeline. He had learned that Linda's task was to write the software for the third stage of the Saturn V rocket, several years before it was even built and flown, for what was called TLI, Translunar Injection. It was software that at a very precise moment would fire off the third stage rocket to propel the Apollo spacecraft out of Earth orbit and send it soaring toward the moon at nearly 25,000 miles per hour. The challenge? She was aiming at an imaginary place in space where the moon would be 3 days later in its orbit around the Earth so that the Apollo spacecraft would skim past the edge of the moon at a precise angle just 60 miles above the lunar surface. It was compared to aiming a pistol shot at a piece of paper set edgewise at 50 yards. Miss by even a fraction, and the command module would crash into the lunar surface. Too far out, and lunar gravity would not sufficiently grab the spacecraft, and it would just go winging off into deep space with no hope of return. She did all of that before she was 23. Reaching the second floor landing, John paused for a moment to soak in the view of Mount Mitchell, hidden briefly by a snow shower and then standing out again, cloaked in deep snow. The heat from the fireplace radiated up from the living room below, and John took off his sweater and enjoyed the warm, comfortable feel.
"Good morning, sir."
Several of John's old students were sitting at a long table where half a dozen computer screens were set up, several of them old Apple II screens,
The other's a mix from a first-generation Macintosh with its terrible blue 9-inch cube screen and two PCs, one in full vivid color. As always, John felt a touch of embarrassment with his inability to remember names, though he recognized the young faces who at one time had sat in his 100 and 200-level history classes, but could usually be found across the hall from his classroom in the room set up as a lab for the college's cybersecurity program. Linda motioned to a couple of chairs set up behind the three, and then pulled up a chair herself in front of the color monitor. "Ernie just finished another calibration this morning on a GeoSync SATCOM device we think is of interest."
"Froze my ass off up on the roof in this damn weather," Ernie growled. "Samantha, that's your job from now on."
He tapped the shoulder of one of the girls sitting in front of an Apple screen. The young woman's hair was unruly, pulled back in a ponytail, and definitely needed a good washing. John remembered her as someone who had been quietly defined as 4F for service with the college's militia due to asthma and a propensity for catching any bug floating around, and had been down with pneumonia more than once. If not for the town's production of antibiotics, the last bout would have killed her. She had finally been tasked with helping to weave the wire for the generators being produced down in Anderson Hall, and was doing a rather poor job even with that. But now she apparently had found her niche.
"Ernie, you keep this girl out of the cold," Linda said protectively. "She's needed more right here."
"So I freeze at my age and she sits here snug and warm."
"Just shut up and leave her be."
Even as the two started to argue, Samantha pointed at the screen where an endless stream of numbers and letters without any semblance of order or reason were cascading down at a near blinding rate at times.
"There it is again, same pattern."
Samantha hit a button on the keypad, which froze the image with an old-fashioned screen capture. Ernie leaned over her shoulder to look.
"What is it?" John asked, curiosity filling him.
"Encrypting," Ernie announced, continuing to stare at the screen.
"Bluemont?"
"No way of knowing yet. If we were sitting on top of a hill looking down at the Bluemont facility, that would be easy enough. Aim a little eavesdropping antenna at one of theirs and start listening in. Most people just assumed everything on computers just flashed around on fiber optics or microwaves, but a lot was going up and down as well, especially government stuff, and of course it was encrypted. You have the right software on your computer, and what looks like gibberish in raw form becomes standard text. Do you remember Kindles? You buy a book, and 30 seconds later it's in your computer. But what was sent was not the actual real text and photos. It was all encrypted to keep hackers from snatching it and then torrenting it out on their own."
"Torrenting?"
"The bane of every author, for starters. Easy, actually. Some bum just scans the text of a book into his computer and then just put it out there as a PDF file. They make a buck or two. The author gets ripped off. Go downstairs and ask my daughter's husband about it, and he'll start raving like a crazy man about getting robbed of hundreds of thousands of dollars from torrenting."
Ernie continued to stare at the screen while talking. All those internet sources for books, music, like Kindle, Nook, iTunes, were dependent on encrypting, and they were damn good at it and were updating their codes almost daily, so that is what we've got to get around. John looked at the other screens. The color one that Linda was sitting in front of was actually showing a wavering video image filled with static.
"And that?"
Linda smiled. "Raw feed from the BBC. Off-the-air stuff. A reporter somewhere up in Canada cursing about getting kicked out of the country. Stuff like that is going out all the time."
"Can we talk to him?"
John asked hopefully. Linda shook her head.
"We don't have any kind of uplink here, just listening."
"Should we get our ham operator guys to try to establish contact with them?"
"Already doing that," Ernie replied.
"Remember one of them talked with us several days after we snatched that Black Hawk," Maury interjected. "Then nothing. We can only run the radio and the chopper for so long before we have to fire it up to recharge."
John looked around at the equipment scattered on the table. Boxes of additional equipment, computer boards, old empty mini-frame stacks, heavy-duty backup batteries that used to be standard external equipment for most home computers, so that if the power blinked off, the battery kept the system running. John spared a glance into the open door of a bedroom across the hall and saw where there were yet more boxes piled up, some of them stamped Montreat College.
A couple of more students, whom he had vague recollection of once being in his classes, were in that room, leaning over a ubiquitous green computer board, probing at it with a voltmeter. John caught Ernie's eye and motioned for him to follow, not sure where to go until Ernie gestured toward a back room, a spacious affair, and within were yet more boxes, stripped-down computers, television monitors, some flat screens, others old-style, heavy 14- and 16-inch monitors. There was barely room for a desk and a couple of chairs, with Ernie gesturing for John to sit down in one, while from under the desk he pulled out a bottle of brandy, opened it, and without asking poured a couple of ounces into two rather dingy-looking glasses. John did not argue the point this time, and was glad for the warmth of the drink coursing through him seconds later. Ernie also pulled out a cigar and looked to John quizzically, at least for this offer. John reluctantly refused, and Ernie shrugged, bit off the end of his smoke, produced an old-fashioned friction match, and lit it up, the blue smoke curling around John.
"Something bothering you?" Ernie asked.
John wasn't sure how to start as he sipped his drink.
"For starters, I finally relented and said it was okay to recruit a couple of kids for this scheme of yours. Then I find out you all but hijacked the equipment from the college library basement and hauled it all over here without a by your leave. I now see five or more kids working here. Where did you get them from?"
"Paul Hawkins recommended them." John nodded slowly.
"And what jobs did you take them from?"
"Here and there," Ernie said with a bit of a grin.
"I would have liked to have known."
"John, you know you are sounding a bit like a bureaucrat with that. Were we supposed to ask permission?"
"Ernie, you know how many mouths we have to feed between now and when food starts to get produced come late spring. Every hand counts.
And we've got hundreds working on making generators, retrofitting vehicles to burn alternate fuel, even some on your obsession with steam-powered tractors or some sort of mini-locomotive.
We try to find a job everyone can do, but unless under attack, our first priority is food, and more food.
And those tech nerds out there, how much food or whatever can they make versus what they are doing now?"
John nodded, finishing his drink and putting his hand over his glass in refusal, while Ernie poured several ounces more for himself.
"Dare I quote someone we both disdain?" Ernie pressed. "From each according to his ability, you know the rest."
"I'm not saying that, Ernie."
"Well, in defense of what I am doing here, I'm saying it. Those kids are bloody geniuses when hunched over those old screens and damn near useless when it comes to canning beans, trapping rabbits, or toting a gun through the woods without accidentally shooting themselves or someone else. I'm maximizing their effectiveness, and their effectiveness might actually mean figuring what in hell is really going on out in the rest of the world and how it might hit us. Hell, you're the historian. You tell me what role kids like that played in previous wars."
John took that in and finally nodded. "You telling me you got a Bletchley Park out there in the next room?"
"Could be. Maybe one of them is the next Turing who will figure out how to crack the German Enigma code by building a machine to mimic how it works. Maybe not that dramatic, but if you are here on some kind of inspection tour and are about to order them back to whatever they were doing, I'm kicking you out of my house. The Franklin clan will close up the gates and survive on our own again."
"And those kids stay here."
John looked up to see Linda standing in the doorway, most likely having listened to the entire conversation.
"You feeding them as I requested?" John asked.
"That's right," Linda replied with a smile.
"You have that kind of surplus?"
"Be prepared, as my husband said."
John looked down at the freshly opened bottle of brandy stashed beneath Ernie's desk, the cigar resting in the ashtray, and wondered how, after 2.5 years, this family still seemed to have enough to keep going without ever asking for additional help. But as he had resolved back in the first days when the responsibility fell upon him to try to organize his community to survive and defend itself, when it came to those who had prepared before the day, his policy of don't ask, don't tell had to stand. He was not a commissar out to redistribute what was left or, as most likely happened in far too many places, point a finger at the 1% who'd had the foresight to be ready and shout for the other 99% to kill and loot them, just so all could fill their stomachs for a few extra days and then go back to starving.
"We'll feed and house them,"
Linda announced, pressing in on John's musings.
That poor skinny rail Samantha was half-starved to death. Most of her peers pitied her, but saw her as not good for much of anything other than consuming a ration a day. Here she is back where she belongs, and the others view her as some sort of guru, and definitely a leader they turn to for advice. John, in the vicious triage of the world you have to deal with, and God save you, I know what a hell it must be, that girl most likely would have died before spring, and except for a few close friends been mourned by a few.
Linda's words were a slap of reproach, and they stung. He lowered his head.
Point made, Linda. She stays.
So many like her had indeed died, so ill-suited to be hunters, at times hunters of other men, or gatherers and sowers. Samantha was the luxury of an advanced technological age that so many like her had actually created, a world that all others once lived off of, even though they did not understand the hows or whys, but would curse if their 60-inch flat screen hooked to a satellite dish went on the blink during a Super Bowl, or news of what some star had done that day to further titillate a society even as it headed to the brink of disaster and then fell. The nerds in the basement, which too many once mocked, even while dependent upon them for their jobs, their entertainment, and indeed their very lives when it came to the infrastructure, had been held in mocking disdain by far too many. Little did anyone realize their importance until the moment everyone was brought to their knees in sharp flashes of nuclear light, far above the atmosphere.
"All right, it stays as it is. Now tell me your goals," John said.
Ernie, seeing that John's hand was no longer covering his glass, poured him a few more ounces, and for once John did not resist. Linda and Ernie were running the show for the moment, and he realized it was time to just listen and perhaps relax a bit.
"Something is about to happen," Linda announced. "Ernie and I worked in our fields for about 50 years. Good years with NASA, IBM, and then our own business with the satellite antennas. We were good because we learned to have a gut feel for things at times and stay a jump ahead of the game."
"What she is trying to say," Ernie started to interject.
"Damn it, Ernie, I know what I am about to say," she snapped, and John could not help but smile.
Ernie might intimidate most folks in town, but in this house, he could see it was an open fight at times, and at times Linda won.
"We knew Apollo would work, but the shuttle was an insane design. Putting a manned crew atop solid rocket boosters that could not be turned off once lit, the way a liquid engine could be shut down, was asking for disaster. We and others warned and were ignored. We, along with others, tried to point out the fatal flaw of the insulation coating in the liquid fuel tank as well. It might just be spray-on foam, but if a piece the size of a kitchen counter snapped off and struck a wing during liftoff, it could prove fatal. The math was simple. Regardless of mass, it was about velocity at impact that counted. Again, we were ignored, and then we watched in horror as Columbia broke up on re-entry because of that exact reason."
She was digressing from the discussion of the moment, but he let her continue, knowing she was reaching toward a significant point and expressing frustrations that still haunted her.
"IBM was going to miss the boat with the PC market. We tried to tell the management, idiots in business suits, that. Their reply, no one really wanted a computer in their house, but would rely on them to provide big mainframe systems run, of course, by IBM people in white jackets. Of course, that meant all of America would pay to be able to dial in and pay yet another fee via old AT&T to hook into our machines. I remember them pitching that in one of their World of Tomorrow programs at a World's Fair. So here we are, in the world of tomorrow," she said with a sigh. She gestured back to the room where the students were working. "They just might crack something, and it might mean the difference between our surviving or not. Your friend the general was giving you a warning. He is going to come down on us. He wants it to be without bloodshed, but regardless, he has his orders already. But what are the orders?" not just against us, but long term. He didn't say anything about what that poor dying fellow... What was his name?
Quentin.
What that poor man said about an EMP. And your friend didn't reply.
Why?
I think he isn't sure himself, John replied, hoping that was the real reason, and not because he was already aware of some plan and going along with it.
Then let's find out.
John downed the rest of the drink Ernie had poured for him, and it did go to his head. It was a welcome relief. He realized Linda was right. Something was coming, and unlike the threat of the posse, or even Frederick's, who showed his hand before he fully struck, this time he just was not sure what the hell was about to happen next.
And something else is worrying me, John.
What is it?
You. The General was giving you a personal warning as well. I pray for you every day, and that prayer now includes that you take heed of his warning.
John smiled but said nothing.
Be careful, John. Very careful.
Of course, he said, trying not to sound dismissive. And okay, you win. Put them to it, and while you do, you feed and house them. Is that all right with you two? Linda smiled.
You see, Ernie, I know he'd see it our way.
5 extra mouths to feed, Ernie sighed. Sure we can't draw some rations for them, John?
5. I only saw 3 in that room.
There's 2 more up on the roof installing another 10-foot-wide satellite dish we salvaged yesterday from a trailer down near Old Fort.
As John had already conceded who fed and housed the students, there was no sense in arguing about 2 more, and he let it go.
Those things will be damn visible on your roof, John ventured.
Don't worry, we already thought of that,
Linda replied.
They're screened with some camouflage made from bedsheets to blend in with the snow covering our roof.
John shook his head. If anything, he was feeling a twinge of guilt over the kids like Samantha, until the realization that there were at least some computers capable of being restored, put back online, and then turned to a useful, perhaps crucial, purpose, kids like her had languished, no longer fitting in. And without doubt, more than a few of them had died in this harsh new world. If they again had purpose, perhaps a crucial purpose, then he felt at this moment their society had at least taken yet another small step out of the darkness.
I think you Franklins have more than enough rations to go around for 5 extra mouths, at least until the next harvest starts to come in.
Ernie barely cracked a smile. Be prepared, John. If all of us had thought that way, we wouldn't be counting every bean or ear of corn and calculating if we should throw them to a pig or eat them ourselves. Yeah, we can feed them.
Point taken, was all John could say.
Fine, then. Now I've got a stew ready to ladle out. You and Maury stay.
Agreed?
John felt no guilt with accepting. Too often someone else would offer a meal of watery soup or a stew with some fragments of squirrel or raccoon mixed in with wild onions and greens, and he always politely refused such paltry fare, not because he wasn't hungry, but because it was one extra meal that whomever he was visiting could better use with their raggedy-clad children. The entire extended family, Franklin's and their newly adopted charges, gathered around their dining room table, Ernie standing to offer grace while all joined hands. The room was actually warm in spite of the cold, wintry blast swirling outside their south-facing windows, the fireplace glowing hot with heavy, crackling logs stacked in. John felt a wave of nostalgia with the gathering. He often lost track now of exactly what day of the week it was. In warm weather, going to church on Sunday had become a looked-forward-to weekly event in the college's chapel, which was still under repair from the battle back in the spring. But with the harsh weather of the last month and Michaela's advanced state of pregnancy, the walk from their home up to Gaither Hall had been set aside. It wasn't just the gathering around a family table for a filling meal that hit hard. It was the way everyone held hands with heads lowered, offering a prayer of thanksgiving that filled him with emotion. Perhaps Linda and Ernie were putting on a bit of show for their guest and new lodgers, but then again, he knew they were above that. It was a continuation of old Southern traditions, of family and friends gathered together for a Sunday afternoon of sharing and thanksgiving. And that realization hit him now as well. When was Thanksgiving? Was it next week, or was it already past? Had they lost touch with that after but 2.5 years? As Ernie ladled out each bowl in turn and passed it on, John found he could not help but watch it hungrily. The meat did not strike him as fresh. It most likely came from a freeze-dried can of emergency rations, but it was still meat, mixed in with what appeared to be real potatoes and a sprinkling of greens. What truly set his mouth to watering was not just the stew, but the scent of freshly baked bread as well. Part of the modern kitchen fixtures had been pulled out long ago, with an old-fashioned kitchen wood stove set in as a replacement, with Linda leaving the table for a moment to pull a large loaf of bread out of the oven and setting it down in front of Ernie to be cut into thick slices, and then passed around as well. Stew and bread set before him, he looked down at the feast and found it hard not to fill up with emotion, wishing that Michaela was here as well. He felt guilty that such a meal was before him. "John Matherson, don't let that get cold." He looked up and saw Linda gazing at him, not sternly, but with a glint of affection, as if reading his thoughts. "There's more than enough to go around, and I'll have a bowl and a slice of fresh-baked bread for you to take home to your good wife." He could not find the voice to reply and simply nodded, not used to such maternal gestures, especially now that Jen was gone. He ate in silence and barely listened to the family chatter, teasing of a brother to their daughter implying she might be expecting, the grandchildren announcing that they planned to go sledding down the driveway, Ernie admonishing that there was still the wood-splitting and hauling detail to see to. As for the students now living with them, Linda, without any overt show, just quietly walked behind them with a steaming ladle and put a bit of extra stew in each of their bowls. And no one else at the table complained about this second helping, and John felt a flood of emotion as Samantha looked up at Linda, whispered a thank you, and then struggled and failed to hold back tears of gratitude for a meal unlike any she had most likely seen in years. Linda leaned over to hug her, and the girl began to cry openly. No one spoke. And then, to help cover the girl's embarrassment with her emotional display, one of the grandchildren insisted she go sledding with them after the meal was done. It was the most John could recall having eaten in weeks. Or was it months? Perhaps the meal the evening after the battle that had taken out Fredericks, when he and those who had fought that day were each handed to eat at one sitting, at John's insistence, an entire MRE from the stockpile they had captured. Nearly 4,000 calories of food, all in one sitting. As he looked around at those gathered with him, a favorite hymn came to mind that Aaron Copland had titled Simple Gifts. As if there were some sort of mental prompting, with the meal done, the daughter got up, went over to the piano in the living room, thumbed through a layer of sheet music, picked out a piece by Debussy that John recognized, and began to play. There was a moment of silence from the others as they listened appreciatively. It flashed John to the day he was in Gaither Chapel with Michaela, and a student was singing the haunting song, Try to Remember, a song that so symbolized to John the world they now lived in. The daughter just simply playing a song took John to the thought of a world that must have existed even before his own time, when a family would gather for Sunday dinner, and then afterward someone would play the piano and perhaps others might even sing. "We've lost so much," he realized. "But then again, maybe we are learning again about the simple gifts of still being alive, the gifts of a warm, filling meal, family and friends together, and rather than the cluttering noise of some ridiculous game turned up too loudly on a television afterward, it was instead a family entertaining themselves while the cold wind of winter swept down from out of the mountains and across icicle-coated orchards and snow-drifted fields beyond. He realized that at this moment, whatever was about to come, it was good to be alive. Chapter 10.
"John, wake up! Wake up! We're under attack!"
It was the dream,
The jumble of dreams that always ended with him bolt upright in bed, sweat-soaked, shivering, out on the desert, the Bradley up ahead burning, racing forward to find the medics already pulling out the charred bodies, two of them still alive, faces burned black, red mouths open, screaming, and he stood helpless, could do nothing other than stare in shock. Doc Keller pulling back a blanket, revealing Ben, the father of his grandson, features contorted in the agony of death. Then Jennifer.
John, wake up.
He was sitting up, shaking, the room freezing cold, Michaela's arms around him, kissing him awake. He opened his eyes. This time there was no soothing, kissing his forehead, wiping the sweat from his face, whispering it was okay. It was just the dream again.
You've got to wake up now. Reverend Black's on the phone. We're being attacked.
He nodded, standing up, bare feet hitting the freezing cold floor, shocking him, Michaela helping him to put on a heavy bathrobe, steadying him as consciousness returned.
Who's calling?
Reverend Black. John, there are helicopters circling.
She started to lead him to the sunroom where the phone was.
Who? Where?
She picked up the receiver of the phone, an old-fashioned black rotary unit, and handed it to him.
Matheson here.
John, it's Black. I'm at the campus office. We've got three Apaches overhead. Can't you hear them?
That finally startled him awake, and he realized the room was reverberating with a low, steady rumble. He walked to the sunroom window, which was half-covered with frost, looked out, and caught the glint of flashing rotors sweeping by overhead.
Any shooting?
Not yet. John continued to look out the window. The choppers were staying high, circling out along the crest line of Lookout Mountain. He watched them for a moment, catching glimpses.
Any come in low over the campus?
Not yet. He could hear the nervousness in Black's voice. Get on the phone to downtown Black Mountain, Asheville, any connections we have. Tell them not to shoot unless fired upon first and report anything they're seeing. I'll be right up. He hung up. Michaela was already scrambling to fetch clothing and boots, helping John to get dressed.
What is it? She asked.
Not sure, but if it's a surprise attack with intent to kill, they'd already be hitting us.
Pulling on his boots, he heard a vehicle outside, and opening the door, he saw that it was Maury in his jeep. John ran out to him, looking up, the distinct thump of a helicopter rising in pitch as the chopper raced by overhead, still keeping altitude.
What the hell is going on?
Maury shouted as John climbed in, brushing snow off the passenger seat before sitting down.
They're military, desert camo pattern. They must be with General Scales. Get me to the office.
Maury spun the jeep around through the deep snow and set off downhill to Montreat Road, the vehicle skidding as he hit the base of the road and went sideways onto the main street through the village without slowing. Maury edged off the road to get around a tree that had fallen in the last storm and had yet to be cleared, and then turned to race up to Gaither Hall. As they skidded to a stop, John looked up again and saw that there were several Blackhawks as well, slowly circling at more than 1,000 feet above the narrow valley. Black was at the office door, motioning for John to come in. Out on the snow-covered front lawn, a dozen or more students were looking up, all of them with weapons. One of them was Grace.
"Do not point your weapons at them. Everyone get the hell inside," John shouted.
"Someone on the ham radio asking for you."
John went to the radio, the tinny-sounding speaker crackling.
"Matheson, this is Bob Scales. Please respond."
John picked up the old-fashioned handheld mic and clicked it several times before replying.
"Matheson here. Bob, are you overhead?"
A momentary pause.
"Affirmative, John. Assumed you were in that jeep."
"Yes, sir."
"Nice vehicle. I'd like to see it up close."
John hesitated for a moment.
"You're welcome to land, but flag off those Apaches and send them home."
"Can't do it, John. Please listen carefully. I'm asking for your immediate surrender."
"You've got to be kidding."
"John, I've got assets over you that can take down your campus and all those kids in 5 minutes. We're already landing in Asheville. You might have disabled the Asheville airport, but I have two C-130s touching down on the interstate next to it. I've also got a support column on the ground coming up from Greenville, and they have some Bradleys. It's your call. I'll give you 5 minutes to think it over."
John put the mic down and looked at Reverend Black and Maury. They were silent, staring at him. The phone began to ring. Black picked it up, listened for a moment, simply said, "We already know," and looked at John, still holding the receiver. "That was done in downtown Asheville. He said several Blackhawks have touched down near the county office complex. They'll be in his office in another few minutes."
Any fighting? Black relayed the question, sighed, and looked back to John. One of the security team there is shot. Bad. Fired on them as they landed. John looked back out the window, helicopters still circling, and in spite of his orders, students were coming out of buildings, some already in winter camo, weapons up.
"John, what are you going to do?" Black whispered, still holding the phone.
He looked at his troops, his kids. Against the posse, even against Fredericks, it was one thing, and those two fights had cost dearly. This time, it would be a bloodbath, and for what?
"We don't stand a chance against them," John sighed.
"I know Bob Scales. This is the A-team, not those pathetic ANR kids they threw at us last spring."
"John, I need your answer now."
It was Bob again on the radio.
"I just got a report a couple of your people and mine were shot in Asheville. Stop it before it turns into a full-scale fight."
He wanted to shout back that it was Bob who was starting it with this surprise assault coming in at dawn.
"John, they've got us,"
Maury said softly, and John finally nodded. "Reverend, tell Dunn to stand down, disarm, and surrender. Get on the phone to all locations, tell them not to fire, to stand down, and await word from me later. Repeat, do not resist. You got it." Reverend Black sighed.
"John, you're making the right move."
"Yeah, I know," he replied bitterly. "Maury, get outside. Tell those darn kids to get back inside. Find Kevin Mullady. Tell him everyone is to return to their rooms, stack weapons, and show no resistance. Got that?" Maury could only nod and went back out the door as John picked up the mic and clicked it. "Okay, Bob. We surrender on your word that my people are to be treated with respect. No reprisals or arrests. It's got to be the code we once lived by, sir."
"Agreed.
Wait 15 minutes so I make sure the word is out. There's a baseball field above the campus. You can set down there."
15 minutes, then. Bring your jeep up to meet me, John. Make sure your people do not fire. If they do, you know what I have to do in reply."
"Understood." He could hear Bob click off.
"I should have expected this," he thought bitterly. "But then again, what could I do differently?"
After 2.5 years of successfully managing the defense of his community, to be caught like this was galling. Frustrated, he threw the mic down and walked outside. The rotor of the Black Hawk came to a stop, John at last able to lower his hands from his face as the swirling snow settled down. 3 Black Hawks had landed, troops piling out of the first 2, weapons raised, forming a defensive perimeter, while overhead the 3 Apaches continued to circle. Their nose guns were turned away, outward and not in toward the campus, a smart gesture on Bob's part. But their presence was menacing nevertheless, the sounds, the sights, and smells taking John back to the desert of Iraq so long ago. John stood by the jeep, Maury at his side. The world felt cold, empty. Could he trust Bob? Or was this all a ruse? He'd grown used to winning, to always somehow pulling the chestnuts out of the fire. And now, after 2.5 years, the game was up. Whatever it was that Bluemont wanted, they now had it. How brilliantly it was done, to send in a man John once served under, had trusted, respected, and considered to be his friend. It was all up to Bluemont now. He had defied them because of Fredericks, the type of man who, across his years of military service, he had learned to hold in contempt. The quintessential bureaucrat, the type where, in the face of all logical argument, at times with the lives of men in the balance, would smile that disdainful smile, implying that an Ivy League degree in public administration trumped reality in the field. Was that what Bob was serving? If so, regardless of the promises made minutes ago, John could see what would follow. Local community control was finished. The high talk back in the spring of a reaffirmation of the Constitution, of their expanding out across the Carolinas, bringing at least some semblance of a technological infrastructure back online to themselves and their neighbors, gone. There would be no fight now. Perhaps the first gesture to smooth things over would be a bribe of reassurance. Some truckloads of MREs brought up from the coast. perhaps even already packed along with the column invading up from Greenville, South Carolina. Then, a new administrator, another Fredericks, and with him new rulings, the logic that a local militia was no longer needed for self-defense now that the regulars were here, but the young men and women of his community would be needed elsewhere and an order given. He could see it all so clearly, even as he felt a surge of emotion as the side door of the third Black Hawk slid open and Bob Scales alighted. Behind him a detail of 8 well-armed men, some in desert camo, others in winter uniforms, who joined the defensive perimeter. John did not make the gesture of going forward to meet Bob, waiting as he struggled alone through the knee-deep snow, moving slowly. Bob stopped half a dozen feet away from John and gazed into his eyes, saying nothing. "Sir, if you are expecting me to salute this time, I'm sorry, I can't." A flicker of a smile creased his old friend's features. "At least present your sword as a token of surrender, and I'll return it graciously," Bob replied. John kept his features fixed. Memories flooded in of his year with Bob at the War College, participating in the traditional staff rides to Gettysburg, the hours spent together analyzing the battle while walking the fields with the rising young officers who were their students and getting a lesson not only about the battle itself, but also the traditions of the military in which they served, that they would fight ferociously for the cause they believed was right and to which they had sworn their sacred honor, but could as well show compassion and share the last drop of a canteen with a foe who had tried to kill them but minutes before. "Okay, forget the sword, but can we at least get out of the cold?" Bob suggested. "Can I request that you call off those Apaches overhead? They're making my people extremely nervous. Last time we had Apaches here, they shot up our chapel and hospital and killed dozens." Bob nodded. "You can assure me that where they sit down, no action will be taken. If they land back at the airport where we met, there is no one there, close enough to cover you if needed, far enough away to ease things here a bit. Your word of honor on that, John?" "Yes." He hesitated for a few seconds. "On my word of honor, sir." "By the way, I already have a team there," Bob announced.
"Why there?"
"Seemed like a good staging area, and besides, they're looking for a lost Black Hawk. Figured it might be stashed in one of the hangars. All right, I'll order them back to that airport."
Bob turned and shouted an order. One of the troopers deployed on the security perimeter around the choppers nodded and went to the pilot's window of the Black Hawk Bob had come in on. Seconds later, the three Apaches turned sharply to the southeast and began to climb out of the valley.
"Satisfied?" Bob asked.
"It helps."
"Now can we get in out of the cold?"
John nodded and pointed to the jeep. Bob climbed into the passenger seat. The trooper who had passed his order to the pilot shouted a protest and started to come forward, weapon not pointed toward them directly but raised to the ready.
"It's all right, Captain," Bob shouted. "Wait here." "But, sir, I'm with friends. Order the men to keep perimeter and wait. I'll be back in 1 hour."
The captain nodded reluctantly, saluted, and turned away.
"He gets a little too nervous about me at times," Bob said.
"I hope he doesn't get nervous while we're gone." "Not a threat, sir, but there are well over 100 heavily armed people down there." He nodded back toward the campus.
"I trust you. Just make sure they stay away from where the choppers are waiting."
John did not reply.
"You do know that if I am not back in 1 hour, things can quickly grow ugly."
"Are you doubting my word?"
He paused.
"General?"
Bob looked back at John, who was climbing into the narrow back seat, smiling but glance firm. "I trust you. We both have to trust each other now."
Again, John did not reply. "Take us together, Maury," John said to Maury, who switched the jeep's engine on and put it in gear.
"Your name Maury?" Bob asked.
"Yes, sir."
"Nice jeep. Original?"
1942 Wills.
During the short drive back to Gaither, Bob chatted with Maury about the jeep, its history, and how he always preferred them to Humvees.
As they passed the library on one side and the girls' dorm on the other side of the road, John could see anxious faces peering out of windows.
nearly all still in winter camo, weapons slung on their shoulders. Milady stood in the doorway of the dorm, ready to go. John told Maury to stop. "Kevin, keep everyone inside, weapons grounded. And for heaven's sake, no one is to go near where the choppers landed. You got that? Once you feel things are secure with our people, report to me down in Gaither."
"Yes, sir."
Kevin made the gesture of saluting, even as John told Maury to head on to Gaither Hall. They turned into the rear parking lot of Gaither, slid to a stop, and dismounted. Bob offered his hand to Maury, who reluctantly took it, and thanked him for the ride and brief history lesson about jeeps. John climbed out of the back of the jeep and led the way inside. The corridor was packed with anxious students and staff, all of them suited up, all of them armed. John stopped, looking over his shoulder at Bob, who came in behind him, pulling back the hood of his parka. The old general did not hesitate or show fear. He actually smiled, coming up to John's side. It was a tense moment. John took a step forward and held up his hand in a calming gesture. "This is General Scales. He is an old friend from long before the day. General, these are some of my troops." Bob actually stiffened and offered a salute, which some then returned, though many continued to just stand in silence, their hostile gazes obvious.
"Colonel Matherson, my compliments. You have a good-looking command here."
"Good-looking?" John tried to not show any reaction. In an earlier age, a world long ago, those standing in the hallway would have been described as a ragtag-looking bunch at best. Winter camo made out of bedsheets, most of the young men unshaven, all of them thin, wiry after 2.5 years of privation and 2 deadly campaigns behind them. A few had offered salutes in return, but the rest were wary, eyes cold and obviously expecting that before the day was out it would turn into a fight to the death, and though scared, were ready to face it. "All of you," John said in a calm voice, "we are in stand-down. I want you to keep your weapons slung and follow proper procedure to ensure chambers are empty. We don't need an accident. Remember what I told you about how things went out of control at Lexington Green. We don't want that here because one hothead takes matters into their own hands. Do we understand each other?"
"Sir, are we surrendering without a fight?"
one of them cried. "We are not at war here. The general is here to talk things over."
"With Apaches as an opening move?"
another student shouted angrily. "All of you listen to me. This is not Fredericks. I know this man. He could have come in here with gunships tearing us apart before we even knew what was hitting us. He's here to talk. So I want all of you to relax, get back to whatever your assigned duties are, ground your weapons, and for now leave them in Fellowship Hall if you are going outside. No one is to go near the ball field. The troops up there have firm orders to protect those helicopters, and that means shoot first and ask questions later. Your venturing up there could be seen as a hostile approach, and then... Lexington Green again. You all got that?" There were nods, a few soft, "yes, sir," replies, all of them saluting John while avoiding eye contact with Bob, an obvious gesture to indicate who was still in charge, as far as they were concerned, and the group started to disperse. John opened the door to what had been the president's office, motioned for Bob to step in, and then closed the door behind him.
"You handled that well, John, thank you.
What else was I to do? Order them to shoot you and then storm the field and get slaughtered?" Bob looked around the room, offering a smile as he took his parka off.
"Lord, I do recall this room. Remember I visited this campus years ago."
He paused for a moment.
"Mary was buried out of this chapel. Our friend Dan Hunt was president. I sat in here with him after the service for Mary. I remember he was in tears for you that day."
John offered a chair at the long meeting table and turned away for a moment so emotions wouldn't show as Bob conjured up the memory of that day. It was Bob who had recommended John for the job at this college, having served with Dan Hunt, the two of them classmates from West Point.
"I don't see him here,"
Bob said softly.
"He didn't make it. Died during the starving time after everything went to hell."
He looked back at Bob, who was gazing at Dan's favorite painting, George Washington kneeling in the snow in prayer at Valley Forge.
"The list goes on and on,"
Bob said softly. All those who didn't make it. I wondered about you across these years, sir, John replied. But now you are here.
You take inspiration from that painting? Bob asked. Is that why you kept it?
John studied it for a moment. Only recently started to use this office just for state council meetings. I felt it was kind of a shrine to a good leader, but yeah, on a day like this, it's worth studying. Bob did not respond to John's obvious touch of cynicism. How Washington kept his strength through that winter at Valley Forge is beyond me at times. If he had lost his way, the American Revolution would have truly been lost. That's worth thinking about now. Bob turned his gaze from the painting to John, and there seemed to be a flash of warning.
"Let's get to business, John," he announced, and he sat down at the far end of the table.
"Formal surrender, is that it, sir? It's Appomattox, you're Grant, and I'm Lee."
"I prefer not to think of it that way. Call it rejoining the Union we both swore an oath to."
"You mean Bluemont?" Bob hesitated.
"You seem damn hostile to them."
"I have every reason to be hostile. This community lost over 100 dead to that tin-pot dictator they sent down here back in the spring. Before we leave, I want you to take a look at our chapel. We're still repairing it. Those troops out in the hallway, they have every reason to mistrust. They all buried friends, several of them spouses by the time it was done. How else should we react?"
"Were they students of yours, John?"
"You mean now or before the day?"
"You know what I mean."
John smiled sadly. "Yes, that girl who spoke up asking if we were surrendering."
"You mean the one who would not salute me, but definitely saluted you?"
"That one, yes. She was a Bible studies major. Loved history. Good kid from a good family that came up here every month to visit, and all of them would sit in on one of my evening classes. Her family lived in Florida." With the mention of Florida, he saw the sudden look in Bob's eyes.
"Sorry I mentioned that place, sir."
Bob sighed.
"Like I said, I know my Linda is gone. I just pray it was peaceful."
"Same for that girl. She got married in our chapel across the hall a year ago. Had a baby 3 months ago. No husband now. He was killed in the attack where Fredericks was hauled up at the end."
"I understand the tough edge to her now,"
Bob replied. "We all have tough edges now, sir. No father for her baby. Nightmares as to what happened to the rest of her family. This school is all she knows now." He hesitated. "She feels she has nothing to lose if she dies fighting to defend it."
"There is no need anymore to fight, John."
"Really, sir?" He could not control the sarcasm in his voice, but Bob did not react.
"Damn, I'm cold and thirsty."
"It's a dry campus, Bob. At least we try to keep it that way."
"Coffee, then?"
Bob asked hopefully. "None of that either. All those K-cups of coffee belong to my friend Forrest. You remember him, the sergeant who left an arm in Afghanistan, but I can roust up some herbal tea."
"Please, if you don't mind."
John nodded, left the office, and leaned over the Dutch door that led down to the old business office, which had been converted into the formal administrative office of the town. He shouted down the stairs, Reverend Black opening the door down below, and John passed along the request. He returned to the president's office, where Bob had returned to staring at the painting of George Washington.
"Do you think he really prayed like that in the snow of that winter?"
Bob asked. "He was a man of faith. And if ever this country needed faith, it was that winter. So, yes, I believe it is real."
"So do I,"
Bob said softly. The two were silent for a moment, both gazing at the painting. The historian in John knew that the weather during that first winter at Valley Forge was nowhere near as severe as the one at Morristown, New Jersey, a couple of years later when the army was encamped at Jockey Hollow. Several units, unpaid, unshod, desperate, and hungry, had finally mutinied. Washington had taken the hard choice of executing several of the ringleaders, and in a tense standoff was ready to order troops still loyal to the cause to fire, if need be, on the regiments in mutiny. The revolution had indeed hung by the slenderest of threads on that desperate day. Only Washington's strength of character and leadership had prevented a complete breakdown of the army and the collapse of his years of effort, with all disintegrating into chaos and most likely dictatorship or capitulation. There was a tap on the door, his friend Reverend Black bringing in two steaming mugs of herbal tea. John thanked him, and there was a moment of hesitation. John made the formal introductions, Bob coming to his feet to shake Black's hand. "Everything all right? Everyone standing down?" John asked. "It's not good over Asheville. Half a dozen dead and wounded. I spoke on the phone with some officer who said he had just placed our person Dunn there under arrest." John looked over at Bob. "I'll straighten that out once I'm done here, John." "So are we all under arrest?" John asked coldly. "I didn't want any bloodshed," Bob replied. "I promised to straighten it out." "Tell that to the families of the dead," Black snapped back. Bob nodded, keeping his composure. "If you're still on the phone with them, tell the officer there, it's most likely Major Manetti, that I am safe and secure here. They'll be up there in 2 hours and expect a full report. If fired on, he is not to return fire unless the situation is life-threatening. Can you help me with that, Reverend?" Black looked over at John, who gave a nod of reassurance, and he left. "You could have given us warning," John said. "It would have prevented what happened in Asheville."
"Maybe, maybe not. The way I read things when we last met, I knew I could trust you. But my people who mingled with yours while we were talking, it wasn't good. Reports back were that your people would fight if we just tried to walk in."
"Can you blame them after what the last attempt to bring us into the fold of Bluemont turned into?"
"I balanced all and finally felt this was the right approach. It's tragic that anyone had to die. God knows after what happened in Roanoke, Richmond, and Lynchburg, I know the cost. The only way I felt could work was to show overwhelming force in the first move and count on you being moral and sane in response. It could have been far worse, and you know it."
"So my next question, Bob. Why this? I already told you that before. I've been tasked with establishing a reunified state east of the Appalachians from central Virginia down to the old border of Florida." "Why not Florida as well while you're at it?" Again, he could see the flash of pain in Bob's eyes at the mere mention of that place.
"We've written off Florida. I remember some years ago, I think I read it in American Heritage or some magazine like that, until DDT and air conditioning came along. Except for the coastal regions, the state was relatively empty. Well, it most certainly turned into that after the day, with tens of millions living there, a high percentage of them elderly and dependent on that air conditioning, modern sanitation, a reliable supply of medications, modern hospitals, a freezer full of steaks, cold margaritas out on the screened-in lanai every evening, and, of course, mosquito control. Word is the few left down there again face malaria, cholera, Nile Valley, you name it."
He paused, obviously not appreciating having to dwell on what for him was personal history as well.
"Remember, Central Command for our operations in the Middle East was based in the Tampa, St. Pete area. Within 2 months, they collapsed. The survivors, the lucky survivors evacuated by our Navy, from Miami to Jacksonville, on the other coast, Fort Myers to Pensacola, disintegrated into a sinkhole of anarchy, looting, murder, and then disease and starvation. There are some pockets of survivors along the coast, living again by what they can harvest from the sea as long as pirates don't get them first. The Navy tried to control the waters around there for a while and clean out the pirates, but finally gave up. Florida, like I said, is a write-off."
It was obvious to John that he wanted to leave that subject behind. "Florida's gone, but you were ordered to take this place. Is that it?"
"I'd prefer not to use the term take, John. Call it unite. Reunite. Bring you back in under a central federated government."
"But after Frederick's, suppose we don't want to join?"
"John, you have no choice. To be blunt, it is unite or die."
John chuckled at that and shook his head. I seem to remember that was on our flags during the revolution against an overbearing authority 4,000 miles away.
You're taking it the wrong way, my friend.
Bob, who actually are you serving? I mean, really serving? Bluemont or the oath you swore to the Constitution? Bob fell silent, and there was a look of anger in his eyes. My trust for Bluemont? It's about as far as I can spit into a hurricane, John interjected.
My God, John, so you are going to take that decision upon yourself. You don't trust them, so go to hell and leave us alone, and that's it?
John offered no reply.
I have my orders. I hope you can trust me to see them through and avoid a senseless conflict that you know you cannot win.
He wanted to retort with a conjuring of memories about military ethics classes, the tragic, horrific example of the German army in the 1930s, when the oath of allegiance was one day switched from defending the state to accepting without hesitation all orders from the Führer. So what are your orders regarding here, what we have come to call the State of Carolina?
A bit aggrandizing, that name, isn't it? State of Carolina. Last time I checked a map, your state here controls, what, 5,000 square miles? What about Charlotte, Greensboro, Raleigh? For that matter, there is a garrison in Greenville, Spartanburg, put there by Bluemont, and they have a corridor of control all the way down to Charleston.